Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, and the church and the culture. My name is Derek Rishmawi. I'm joined this week by Matthew Lee Anderson, Alistair Roberts, and the world-renowned televangelist, Andrew
you
Wilson.
You couldn't let it go, could you?
No, let what go? We're proud. One of our Mere Fidelity boys has made it big. He's to the big time.
TBN big
time.
For those
of you who don't know, Andrew Wilson is now the host of a show on TBN UK called Think, is it?
It is.
I think it's, yes, excellent. So he will be talking, and maybe other people will be talking as well, about just things to think about in regard to your faith. I don't know that. What's the show time? What are the details, Andrew?
It's 6:30 p.m. on Sunday evenings in the UK. But
yeah,
I love that your summary of it, given that you can't watch this little house, is things to think about, which is a little half baked.
I would have watched it if I had TBN UK and whatnot. But
you're not a subscriber. I'm surprised.
No, not quite. anyways, on that note, this week though, we want to take up the issue of worship. We had a little bit of a conversation a couple of weeks ago on Hillsong, and that kind of sparked a thread of the question of what is the purpose of our kind of weekly corporate worship when we gather together. What's that meant to achieve? What is its aim? And kind of how does its aim and its purpose shape how we approach it and some of the problems involved with that? So that's what we want to tackle today. With that in mind, I wanted to pitch it over to let's start with Andrew. This week, Andrew, I mean, when you think about worship, when you think about what the corporate gathering, what that's for, in a sense, what's your mindset on that?
Well, it might be helpful to open up. I think how we got this conversation came up as it was in response to some of the discussion on the Hillsong thread. But I also think Alistair and I had a brief exchange about, based on something Jonathan Lehman had said about altar calls, and it just started this little thread of discussion before Christmas. We were talking about it. Really about the extent to which evangelism is a key or important part of gathered church worship. And I guess the church tradition that I'm in would see, obviously, that we've talked before about liturgy and about the components of Christian worship and so on, and the things that you do, and you meet and you pray and you sing hymns and you have preaching of the word and you have the Lord's Supper and so on. But I think that one of the things that I think was just an interesting thing to discuss that I'd love to hear Alistair on a bit more, and I'd happily spar a bit on that, is the extent to which evangelism, or preaching the gospel to people who don't necessarily believe it yet, is an integral part of Christian worship, whether that's something that we should be looking to do every week, whether that's something that should form part of the liturgy of a meeting, or whether a response to the gospel is something that we should offer, whether we do it in the form of altar call or coming to the table or praying at the end or whatever. And really just looking at that dynamic. And I think, in my context, the answer is yes, that is what we do. We would look to share the gospel with people. We have visitors every week who aren't believers, and we would look to have, as a part of what the meeting includes, a presentation of the gospel. And whether or not we have a call people out for a response, we often don't. But I think there are quite a lot of people, not just Alistair, but others, who are commenting back at me on that. Well, no, I think the purpose of the meeting is to make sure that the flock are fed well. And actually, if the gospel is not preached to unbelievers, then that isn't necessarily a problem. And I just thought it was quite an interesting axis. And obviously, then there's a broader discussion about worship that flows out from that. What's the purpose of a Christian gathering? But I thought that was an interesting starting point. And I just, perhaps Alistair might want to chip in as well on where you were coming from on that as well.
So you're saying I got the question wrong. Is that what you're saying, Andrew?
No. I'm narrowing it. I think if somebody says, so how about worship? What do you think about
that? No, that's great.
I think that's just not quite defined, whereas I'm just sort of saying, I think this is, there'll be an interesting
Alistair,
way of narrowing it a bit.
Explain your very wrong position.
Thanks, Andrew. I suspect that part of the difference between our two positions might be found in the extent of our sympathy for the common statement that the church is the only institution that exists primarily for the benefit of those who are not its members. Now, I'd be a lot more critical of that statement. I think it presumes that the choices between the church as a private club, a holy huddle, or the church as an outward-looking, evangelistic and mission-oriented organisation. Whereas for me, the church is neither of those things primarily. The church, when we gather together for our worship on the Lord's Day morning, it's a holy temple. It's a body being formed, and it's a flock being fed. And in these respects, I wonder whether part of what we're wrestling with is our history as evangelicals. Evangelicalism has found many of its origins as a movement that's largely located and focused upon public preaching and the proclamation of the gospel. If you think about the Bebington Quadrilateral, the different elements of evangelical identity, biblicism, cruciformity, conversionism and activism. These tend to place the center of gravity of evangelical identity somewhat outside of the context of the weekly assembly of the people of God, or at least places it in some uneasy relationship with it. Conversionism and activism tends to push us to be evangelistic and outward looking in our gathered worship, whereas this is somewhat of an anomaly within the history of the church. And even within evangelicalism, evangelicalism often arose as a movement alongside more priestly contexts where the church was seen more in that holy temple sort of framework. And if we're thinking in terms of the church as a holy temple, then what is the purpose of our gathering together? It's that we might serve God and that we might be blessed by God and fed and ministered to by him as well. There are times to reach out, but I don't think that the time of gathered worship is that time. And in the same way you spoke about the preaching of the gospel and the altar call, I think there's always a preaching of the gospel. The question is, to whom is that preaching addressed? And I believe the preaching of the gospel within the context of the gathered worship of the church is primarily directed to the people of God, and that one of the things that gets lost when we move beyond that is the upbuilding of the saints. They just get taught the same basic messages again and again and don't grow to the degree that they might do otherwise. And again, there's always an altar call. The altar call is to the table of the Lord, that we might participate and eat and drink together. That's not an altar call in the sense that it's been the metaphor that's been used in the past, where the sacrifice is my sacrifice of my surrendering of my life to Jesus Christ. Rather, it's primarily the sacrifice of Christ that is memorialized, and in that memorial of the sacrifice of Christ, we all sacrifice our lives on the basis of that sacrifice. And so in part, there's a shift in emphasis upon the sacrifice that is central as well.
So can I ask a question? Because one of the things that interested me that Andrew said, and Andrew, I'd like to hear you reflect on this a little, is that you present the gospel for the sake of unbelievers. What does that imply or indicate about the relationship of those within the church to you, the hearing of the gospel? I mean, there's one way of looking at this conversation and just saying something like it's just a false dichotomy, that the announcement of the gospel is for everyone, regardless of sort of where they are with respect to God. And what does that say if there is a sort of special invitation at the end about what goes on in the sermon? Is the sermon itself not a kind of invitation to response? Does it not itself have a structure that requires some kind of reaction to it by the people who are hearing it? So I guess I wonder about some of those distinctions that have been made. The other thing that I think about, I read a really interesting book on the history of sort of secrecy within the early church, and the fact that there were certain aspects of the Christian life that were held back from public pronouncement. And, you know, you had to go through a rigorous sort of testing process to be approved to have access to certain doctrinal truths and so on. And so I guess I wonder whether or not just about the history of sort of worship in these ways.
Yes, I think there probably is a false dichotomy. I imagine nobody, I mean, just biblical, you know, 1 Corinthians 14, make sure you're mindful of the way unbelievers might hear what you're doing in your meeting. And if you do it in the following way, it'll make you look like idiots. And so don't do that. So obviously, I think we all accept there'll be unbelievers in meetings. And therefore, you want to be mindful of that and communicate everything wisely with them in mind. And on the other hand, I don't think anybody thinks that the only purpose for a Christian meeting is simply to preach to people who are not believers. I think, and so in some senses, I think we'd all agree that yes, it's something that you are supposed to be mindful of, and no, it's not the only purpose of the meeting. I think Tim Keller's language of evangelistic worship is good. I think we are here to worship God, but we're to do it in a gospel-shaped way. That means that not only the liturgy itself, but the way in which we present it is both focused on communicating the gospel to believers and mindful of the fact that some people there don't know what the gospel is, and as a result need to have it explained in a way that's winsome and clear and carefully thought through. So I think in my context, that's what I would mean by it, rather than the meeting is all building up to the high point, which is an appeal to people who aren't believers. Instead, I think it's, no, everything we do is meant to be run through the filter of, how is this going to help, or is this going to be meaningful to somebody who's not a believer, as well as the filter, is this going to be edifying for people who are? So it may be that there's much less disagreement than it might, maybe that there is very little disagreement, but that's where I'd be coming from on that. As for the secrets of the early church thing, I mean, I haven't read that book. I don't know. My reading of Paul is that there are some communities in which the church was very isolated from the city, and in which there was a lot of almost mystery about what churches got up to, and the church and the world were very distinct, say Thessalonica, it would seem, and some where the boundaries between the church and the world were very porous, where there were lots of unbelievers wandering into the church and the church were wandering into the world, like Corinth. And so I think that probably the level of contextualization might depend on how often it was the case that an unbeliever came into a Christian meeting. So I'm sure there are contextual factors there, but obviously I don't know the exact details of the book you're talking about, so I don't know how much that would have been true in the second, third centuries. Derek, were you going to chip in a second? Or?
No, I had a couple of thoughts there. One was, you know, the whole false dichotomy thing is kind of running through my head from two different angles. One, I think, you know, Alistair's got a, in a sense, on point about the purpose of the corporate gathering of worshiping God and proclaiming God's glory and God's purposes. I mean, from the beginning, we were created to worship and, in a sense, proclaim the glory of God to all creation and all that we do. But now, post-fall, post-redemption, that is largely caught up in explaining the story of redemption and the gospel. If you're focused on worship, on Christian worship, on proclaiming the excellencies of God and building up believers and building up the church and building up the community, that will of necessity involve regular proclamation of the gospel in our preaching and our teaching and our singing. This is going to be at the heart of it, in which case the gospel should be going out nearly every week, if not every week. And that's even clear, I think, in just the shape of instruction that we have in the New Testament documents themselves. You know, most of these letters from which we get our understanding of the gospel are instructions to already established churches. They're not evangelistic tracts. They are, you know, corrections and instruction for already existing churches and Christians who apparently know the gospel, but apparently need to be reminded. It's just that old, kind of old school thing. You know, Paul preached the gospel to Christians over and over, in which case, splitting between, I don't know, I'm on the side of, I think at the heart of every worship gathering, yes, is the worship of God. And in that, there will be a proclamation to the gospel of the gospel that will build up believers and will go out and be heard by unbelievers. And making sure that that clarity is there for both, I think is wise. I think there's times where you're going to be, you know, those sermons and those worship services where you are kind of be hitting more, you know, the building up angle. But I don't know. I just don't think evangelism is a tertiary or even secondary concern. I think the two are caught up with each other in an integral fashion, each and every week. So, yeah.
I mean, do you see it going wrong in some, like, it'd be helpful for me just to understand are people concerned about? Is there a particular kind of way of doing it that you think, whoa, that's just really overstepped and we've lost the point of worship as being about God and instead turned it into a 90-minute presentation to an unbeliever as to why they should become a Christian every week? Do people see that? I mean, I'm trying to get what's the other side to the version I'm presenting.
Yeah, I mean, in the States you have a lot of churches, and I've been in a number of them, where the sermon does have a kind of reductive, there's a sort of reductive approach to the sermon where it's really oriented towards this one moment where we have to, you know, present the gospel to those who are unbelievers. And that's really like the lens through which everything is filtered, and that does bleed backwards into the way in which the sermon gets structured and the content gets delivered, and it has a kind of lowest common denominator quality to it, such that the sermon itself can't address things that are too advanced or too difficult, because there are those in their midst who are just sort of at the beginning and or not anywhere at all on the sort of spectrum of doctrine. And so it does end up having a kind of reductive quality. I guess I just don't know if the church is a family. So now I want to know about familial metaphors and how those govern our understanding of the church. Because if the church is a family, it does have somewhere a life that is internal and private and that is oriented towards itself, or that has boundaries around it that sort of marks it off as itself. And it seems like the center of that life is the worship of the one God. Like, that is what constitutes us as the people of God. We respond to God. We're people who are called by God. And in our worship, we are answering that call and speaking back to God. And if that's the center of the life of the family, then it seems understandable to me that and reasonable to think that would be the central filter, as Alistair was saying, through which we would evaluate everything, rather than how is this being heard by those who might be in our midst who are not members of this family.
But the question I'm wondering though is that, I don't know, is that the weekly gathering? I don't know, just the New Testament seems to talk about the weekly gathering involving both believers and unbelievers. Now you might think that maybe the time celebrating Lord's Supper was maybe separated off, cordoned off. That was, you know, a familial feast, sharing, participating in the cup and the loaf. That seems to have been, you know, fenced, so to speak. So that seems like one element that would be distinct, that would be familial, that would be cordoned off, even if in some ways it's there's an invitation involved in that. Once you join the family, this feast is for you. For all who have, it's for you. But I guess, I don't know. I think that the main filter thing is maybe what's problematic. I will say I sympathize what you were talking about earlier, Matt, with the reductive, you know, you got to share the gospel every week, and it basically means it turns into a four spiritual laws talk every week somehow, instead of some kind of more textually or contextually sensitive, like understanding the text and its main point, and the gospel is illuminated in it kind of thing. But I don't know, it's still just don't think the pitting of the two against each other in that way is helpful. I think it's helpful to have three or four questions that you ask, and one of them, at least one of them, is, you know, that how will this be received and heard by unbelievers? I also think there is a place for letting things be weird for unbelievers in a healthy way, letting them in a sense have to catch up a bit. You know, when people walk through the door, I mean, the part I think back to youth ministry, and for a while we, you know, with high school ministry, you know, over here in the States, whatever, you get the 4 years, you get freshmen and seniors. And, you know, part of you might think, well, logically we should preach to, like, you know, the sophomores or the juniors, because it's kind of like the range of people. You got the freshmen, you got the seniors, and you kind of meet in a happy middle there. But what we realize is if you don't preach to the seniors, you lose them. You know, if you don't preach to that level, whereas if you're still a little bit above the head of a freshman or a sophomore, or whatever, there's a learning curve that they can adapt to eventually, and that they'll come along. There's something like that I think is okay in the regular corporate worship, where you have an awareness that some weeks, some things will be a little bit more mysterious to the, you know, to the new person in the midst, but that's okay, because they're entering into, in a sense, a new world. They're entering into a new spiritual ecosystem where things, there should be an element of mystery. There should be an element of unfamiliarity that is natural. So I don't know, that was kind of a ramble, but I think I don't think the two concerns are all that,
I think in some ways,
all that in opposition.
In some ways, it's just, it's obviously not a great abstract. In some ways, yeah, that's why I asked Matt, what's the concern? Because in the abstract, I think you'd say, of course you do this. Of course you engage unbelievers as much as possible. Of course you teach the church as much as possible. Of course you worship God in everything you do. I think what interested me was that when you have a public conversation about it, there's a lot of people, even from the kinds of churches that, I say even from, as if they're above it, from the kinds of churches I'm part of and help lead, there are people coming in and saying, yeah, actually we should, the church meeting should really be about Christians being edified and growing, as if there's a sort of slight, there's a possibility for resentment to emerge, really. We don't like the idea that this meeting is actually for the 2% of people here, or if you're in a very evangelistic church, maybe 10% of people, but still it's a small chunk, I expect, even at a very very guest heavy church. I mean, you mentioned Hillsong. When I went to Hillsong London, I thought this is a small portion of the congregation are not believers, even here. Yet there's obviously still a sense that too many meetings in churches like mine are directing too much of their content towards that small chunk of people to the detriment of the rest. And so in some ways, I'm just trying to tease out what are the things like that I might be doing, or that we might be doing, that might mean that was true. And so I just, yeah, that's where I'm coming from, really, the specifics, because I think otherwise it's a bit of an abstract, yes, of course we should do this, of course we should do that. I imagine lots of people would say that, but the way that that would be implemented on the ground might still be vastly different. And I might come to your church, or you might come to mine and think, what are you doing with that? So that's what I'm trying to get out, really, is, you know, where does it have the propensity to go wrong without setting up a straw man, like the entire thing as a 60-minute journey to the four spiritual laws? That may happen sometimes, but I imagine that's not that common. I'm just sort of thinking, what are the more obvious examples of things that churches like mine might do wrong that lead to that impression? So,
well, and I think part of it's the displacement of, you know, the broader life of, you know, catechesis, and you know, we used to have two service, you know, used to have morning and evening services where the focus in each could be different. You know, so these things. I will say this, part of the problem comes when all of the weight of what the church is and is supposed to be doing falls on that hour to 75 minutes a week, where it's like, well, this is where we've got to get all our evangelizing, discipling, building up, worshiping, preaching, teaching. When all that is supposed to happen in 75 minutes, something's going to suffer, right? Unless you have a broader framework of, you know, church discipleship, mentoring, pastoral counsel, and development that the church is involved in as the whole congregation. I think that's one of the other problems, is we're just trying to do, we have a lot to do in an increasingly shrinking window each week. I don't know, that's
well, yeah. I mean, partly the solution to that increasingly shrinking window, Derek, has been the rise of customizable and individualized forms of education via, I don't know, podcasts and maybe TV shows that are hosted by famous.
You are
Christian,
such a jackass. That is bloggers. Absolutely over the line.
It's not actually over the line. I mean, you have to expect that with all the conversations that we've had about celebrity pastors and so on, that this was going to be a recurring theme, right?
We're just trying to bask in the glory, Andrew. That's all.
That's right. I mean, really, we just know that your star is headed places, Andrew, and we're trying to hold on for dear life, to ride your coattails as far as you can take.
Finish
us.
The point, man. Finish the point.
No, that was it. It was just a setup for the joke.
No, but what was it though? Because I think that's probably in that there is Christian education. That's in my world, that's quite common actually. That people, I don't mean the TV show thing, but the broader point you're making, I thought sounded like it was a good one. So do you want to carry it on? I mean, unless you think it's a joke.
No, I do think it's true. I mean, that the expansion of Christian education outside of the context of worship services has sort of made I wonder if it has been so popular in the States because so many of our sermons are oriented towards those who are outside of the faith. So there is actually a kind of deep hunger within our churches for more learning and more education that sermons are in fact just not filling in a lot of cases. And so people are turning towards those extra resources. Whereas I actually feel like, you know, hearing a meaty sermon is more than enough food for a week to continue to reflect about it and to think about it. But the other thing that I think Derek pointed to that is really important is the expectations gap. So we have this presumption that in order to reach the 5% of the new people or the 5% of the beginners in the faith, that we have to tailor things to them. When in fact, in order to win them, I think what we have to do is tailor the service towards those who are mature in the faith, those who are seniors in the faith, and present it in a way that's compelling enough to make those who are new in the faith want to go there. It's working with high school students. the way that you interest high school students is by treating them as adults and by talking over their heads and by instilling them within them the confidence that they can understand and that they can rise to the level of adults. And I think there's a similar process in the Christian life where in order to bring people to maturity, you have to speak to them as though they are mature rather than speaking to them as though they are beginners. Obviously, I mean, there's nuances there. Paul will say explicitly, "I am speaking to you as though you are infants," but you always get the sense he's frustrated by that, and it's not. He doesn't think that should be the norm. It's concessions that he's doing. It's concessionary that he's doing that, but he really thinks that the norm should be he should just be able to speak to them as though they are mature and adults in the faith.
I think, I think we're on to some things here. There's some nuances in either direction. In the one point that I have realized is there's that tension of people who are mature in the faith. So the people who are most mature in the faith oftentimes are the ones who need, they're not bothered in hearing the simple things over and over. Just from different places, you know, in scripture, like there's a realization like, man, I just still need to hear some of these basics again. And so they're not bothered when that comes up again. And there's those levels of maturity. There's just normal immaturity. And then there's that second level of kind of, you know, in small groups and stuff where somebody will get mature enough that they're bothered by immaturity. And then there's that third level of maturity where you're mature enough to not get as miffed by the immature that you can deal maturely with them. And I think that there's something of that going on in worship as well, where you're kind of keeping those, in a sense, those three groups in mind, and varying. And I think, man, I don't know if that was really kind of an artificial thing.
Well,
but.
Yeah, Derek, no, I think that's really right. I would, and I don't even know that framing it as I've done, as mature and immature is the right way to do it. Simple and complex might be a better way, right? Because the simplicity of Christ Jesus died to save sinners is, you know, who on one level can't understand that, that there's as simple a claim as possible. But we can, you know, make that vastly more complex. And the more complex you make it, the more understanding you have. And when you go back to Christ Jesus died to save sinners, it has a new texture and a new meaning that even the most advanced upon hearing it can appreciate it and learn from it and grow from it, which is why I led worship through all the way through my undergrad. And I always wanted to do an hour-long worship service that had one song, Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, over and over. It would be the only song that we sang, and we did it, say, seven times, but interspliced with long sections of scripture that would change the character of that song. Because simplicity, the simplicity of it is significantly affected by what's around it, which I think is important for thinking about what happens in worship services and the way the gospel announcement gets delivered at the end, right? If it is kind of tacked on at the end, then it loses, I think it loses something. Whereas if it's embedded in the sermon and surrounded by those complexities and in one sense, there for all to hear, it has a very different character. The other thing, Andrew, that I'd say is just to push back on some of how you might be thinking about this. You said what the harm is of thinking about this way. You know, the difference between the two filters, is this primarily about the worship of God or is this, you know, about evangelism? It's very subtle, right? It's a very fine distinction, which means that the differences in a culture and in a church may not be very obvious, except over a large set of churches over a long period of time. And that just makes it a lot harder to be able to evaluate if what you're looking for is harms to the spiritual life. And I don't know how we solve that problem, but it strikes me that it is a very subtle difference, and it may be very difficult to tell what it is within the life of a church.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think the way I'm presenting it, the way I'd hope to present it would be that you're double filtered. So it's not not replacing the worship of God with evangelism. You're saying this has to be honoring to God, and it has to be edifying for believers. But it also, I think, has to be. I think that's Paul's thinking about corporate worship in the most extended text in which he talks about it, which is 1 Corinthians 11-14. The concern about how unbelievers will perceive and understand what is happening is a significant factor for him. And I think, therefore, it's to be biblical. I think we do need to run that filter through as well, not instead of, just as well. And so for me, the what's the harm wasn't rhetorical. It wasn't, hey, what's the problem? I'm genuinely asking. I'm sure there are problems with the ways that some churches like mine do what I think is evangelistic worship and actually is shortchanging a lot of the saints. I mean, they're to the point that they're feeling like the service is not edifying because it's evangelistic instead. And if that's being done, I don't think anybody would think that's what they're doing. And I dare say it's not in the churches I've visited where I've thought it's definitely happening. They probably wouldn't think it was. So that's why I was asking the question about the concrete examples. Yeah, what is it? I take the point about simple versus complex, but I think we've probably all been in church meetings where you think that is not just a simple message. That's just a very trite, shallow, insubstantial message that doesn't have enough in it to build up a congregation with a range of levels of maturity and understanding. Certainly not if you do it every week. So I think I'm sure there are examples I can think of. I just, perhaps I'm mindful of the fact that there may well be examples in my own church that I'm not aware of. And that's partly hence the discussion, just to see where the blind spots may be. So that's really well. Yeah. That's been very helpful for me, though, because I think it's just helpful to get guys from different traditions looking at it.
I think the most interesting thing, and I will wrap up, is I remember just going through 1 Corinthians last year with my college students. I just remember being forced weekly to instruct, build up, and you're almost forced by that letter to preach the gospel every week. If you can't actually trace a line there, even if the main accent on it is like even church discipline or instruction or whatever, sticking with the flow of the text, kind of going through preaching scripture regularly, even when it's dealing with the complexities and even when it's dealing with, parental instruction and so on and so forth, it's there. And I think having that mindset of fidelity to the text and fidelity of God eventually brings you to regular, I think, evangelistic engagement. But guys, this is complex. This is helpful for me, at least. But we're going to wrap it up there. If you've been listening along, we hope this has been helpful for you as well. Just so you know, we will have links to any show notes, but also if you feel like any of this has been helpful or beneficial to you, we do have a Patreon account that we're going to link at MereOrthodoxy.com on the Mere Fidelity page, just to offset some of the costs. We operate at a loss. And Matt, he's been losing weight and haven't been eating. So we just want to get him some food. And so if you want to help out.
It's not
out,
true, actually.
Matt, it's a joke. It's literally, okay, whatever. On that note, people, we're going to sign off and say thank you for listening.